This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, June 3rd. I'm Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. And welcome back to the Bay for many of you. Coming up this week, we'll talk about the timing of the sockeye run, which may be anyone's guess, but Icicle's Warner Liu is willing to weigh in a bit.
With the warm water we've seen again, second winter, back-to-back, no Bering Sea ice, I'm telling our fleet that I'm guessing it's going to be normal to late. I see no reason to expect anything early.
We take a look at how brailer bags are getting made in Naknek.
And now I've got the strapping in place, and here we go.
Kanaknak Beach erosion seems to be happening pretty fast lately. One scientist offers a theory why.
This always would have happened, but it always depends. The rate would depend on the level of the groundwater. The higher the groundwater, the faster the mass wasting. Add water, get dynamics.
Plus a very special poem from a Unalakleet sophomore and the story behind the song that calls for blessing on the fleet every June in Dillingham.
We ask you to watch over us and hold us in your care. We ask your blessings on the fishers going to sea. We ask your blessings.
Those stories and more coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. One of the two large patrol vessels that help enforce the Bristol Bay fishery will not be here this summer. The state of Alaska has decided to put the 121-foot Wolstad up for sale. Director of the Wildlife Trooper Division, Steve Baer, says the Wolstad, along with the Stimson, give enforcement a large presence in the bay where they can linger near the most active lines.
Sometimes on some of those lines, they get pretty wild and crazy. And then we have other fisheries around the state that are really gentlemen's fishery, and I think people can do it. They're just going to have to say, you know what, this is our resource. We all make a living off this resource. We need to be gentlemen out here, and we're going to kind of help police ourselves.
The state estimates at least $500,000 in annual savings from the salaries for the four crew alone, plus other savings for operating costs once the Wolstad is sold. Commercial fishing in the Eastside districts officially opened Wednesday. The walrus are still hauling out near the north of the Ugashik North Line, and area manager Paul Solomon says Fish and Game will be monitoring things, but the fishery should start as normal.
Well, as of right now, we're still planning on business as usual. So we're not planning on making any changes to the way we approach the season at this point. We are putting a lot of the onus on the fishermen.
The federal government has jurisdiction to protect the safety of the walrus from disturbance. The first major wildfire of the year is burning 50 miles northeast of McGrath today and has grown to over 10,000 acres. Tim Mowry with the Division of Forestry says the Medfra fire started last weekend from a holdover fire in the same area last year.
Fires can sneak down. They go down real deep. They get into that duff, and they can sit there and smolder all winter long under snow. And in the spring, when things warm up and it dries out and we get a little bit of wind, that wind will fan those back to life and expose them, and that's what appears to be the case in the instance of the Medford fire.
Mowry says there are 80 responders on the scene. Wet weather is helping them control the blaze. As of yesterday, there have been a total of 14,600 acres burned and 206 reported wildfires in Alaska so far this year. The special legislative session goes on in Juneau. Lawmakers have made some progress, says District 37 Representative Bryce Edgman from Dillingham.
Well, this past week, we got both the operating and the capital budget passed, and that was a huge undertaking, and not only just that we were able to come to consensus on those two budgets, but as well we were able to get that achieve that super three-quarters threshold of votes it takes to tap into our primary savings account in order to fund the budget.
Support to restructure the permanent fund to pay for state government in the future seems to be waning in the face of an election year. Edgman himself is running for re-election and will be challenged by Republican William Weatherby from King Salmon. A 21-year-old Alaknagik man survived a four-wheeler crash into a moose earlier this week. Kermit Ramey was driving near the old South Shore landfill in the overnight hours Monday into Tuesday when the accident occurred. Ramey was medevaced to Anchorage with a fractured skull and broken collarbone. A King Salmon air traffic controller and air taxi owner-operator was arrested on charges of sexually abusing a minor this week. State troopers say the investigation carried on for nearly a year. 37-year-old Robert Joseph May faces a host of charges, including for alleged reckless operation of an aircraft, for engaging in sexual activities with a minor while he was piloting. He was arrested and is being held on $100,000 bail. And a 5.9 magnitude earthquake was reported off the coast of Perryville this week. It happened at 12:51 noon Tuesday. The quake's epicenter was 46 miles southeast of Perryville. Residents say they felt the quake but reported no damage. More on all of this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. The 2016 commercial salmon season in Bristol Bay opened Wednesday. We don't expect much effort for at least another 2 weeks. But run timing is certainly one of the couple three or four main issues the industry is considering right now, along with fish size, the markets, and those danged walrus. Think of the thousands of individual choices that go into prosecuting the world's largest sockeye salmon run, based on the assumption that the run will show up in the couple-day window it normally has for decades. But 2013 saw one of the earliest returns on record. And 2015, well, you probably recall it was so late, many believed the monster run was a bust, before it suddenly wasn't. Add to this, the spring Togiak herring run, which proved to be the earliest on record by a wide margin, and there's just a lot to think about. My next guest has offered to help make a little sense of it all from his perspective. Warner Liu is the Bristol Bay Fleet Manager for Icicle Seafoods. Warner, it's good to have you back here on this program.
Morning, Dave.
Remind us a little bit about your background with this fishery.
Started with sockeye research at FRI in the 70s. Fished with some of the locals out of Iliamna, Pedro Bay for the 80s. Brief stint at Fish and Game and Icicle Seafoods for the last 20 years or so.
So you've been in both the industry side and as well as the science and research.
I've dug a deep rut on both sides of the net.
How are you looking at this season's run timing? First of all, you say there's not a good correlation between the herring and the salmon returns.
There's no correlation with early herring and sockeye, early or late herring. There's Greg Ruggieroni's theory. He's one of the old research folks out of FRI, and his thought was the run timing is related to not how warm it gets, but how quickly things warm up. And that's certainly what we saw in 2013. 2013 record Nishigek ice, very late spring, and sockeye were record early. And of course, last year, warm from the get-go, and sockeye record late. So, you know, 2 points don't make a trend, but I think they back up Ruggieroni's theory on run timing. So with the warm water we've seen again, second winter, back-to-back, no Bering Sea ice, I'm telling our fleet that I'm guessing it's going to be normal to late. I see no reason to expect anything early. Again, no tie to run timing on for herring. So we had the earliest herring ever. And I don't think it'll be related to sockeye this year at all.
I won't ask you to make a prediction on air because those have a way of coming back to bite people in the tail end or something. But you as a fleet manager, you do have to make calculations for your assets, for Icicle, the tenders and such that need to be where they ought to be and when. And no doubt some of the skippers are asking you for your advice. What are you telling people? You mentioned normal to late, but as we saw last year when people began to calculate mid-season that maybe the run was a bust, there was a miscalculation and workers went home too early and such. Are you hedging at all that it could be either early or it could be late?
I'm telling our fleet that we're getting ready early, but we'll be prepared for late. You know, nothing changes on the operational side. I think there were indicators last season to not to throw in the towel early.
You were one of the few, by the way, as we sort of, and I'm sure you don't want to toot your own horn, but you may have been one of the only ones who continued to hold out and say this run is going to show up.
Well, I was lucky last year. Things, there were indications that the run was going to be late, and that's how it worked out. I'll be watching the same things again this year. But I think last year probably taught everyone a bit of patience.
What do you watch as indicators for run timing? There has to be something other than just the port molar test fishery for people to watch.
Company secret. I'll tell the high school fleet only.
All right. All things considered, what's your outlook for this season? Are you optimistic? Are there some big challenges, new challenges? What's your thinking going in here to 2016?
Oh, every season's a challenge. You know, I think we're all gearing up for another big run. I think there's some wild cards where it could come in stronger than the forecast. And I think we're, on the operational side, gearing up as best as we can, trying to fix some of the mistakes from last year and trying to do better for our fleet this year.
Warner Liu is the fleet manager for Icicle Seafoods in Bristol Bay. Warner, it's always good to have you on this program. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Next up, come along for a walk down the beach. Kanakanak Beach specifically, renowned for its superb subsistence salmon fishing and infamous for its eroding bluffs over the Nooshigak Bay. I told my colleague Jay Barrett at KMXT in Kodiak, who grew up in Dillingham, about how quickly Kanakanak seems to be eroding this spring. He said, "I remember walking it with my mom when I was a kid, and she pointed out to the water from a spot on the bluff near some graves and said, her childhood home was about a half mile out there, about 100 feet in the air." Well, we could dedicate a whole program to such stories, I'm sure. Like those remains of immigrant workers buried a century ago that periodically come out of the cliff and show up on the beach. But let's go looking for a few answers instead.
Down there you see basically a block of sod and soil. And it broke off right from this area here. You see the crack in the cliff face here. This major erosion and undercutting. And we'll go down there and we'll look at, see the water coming out of the cliff face? That's not rain.
This is Dr. Todd Radenbaugh, an environmental science professor at UAF's Bristol Bay campus, who I asked for a little guided tour last week. The water, he says, isn't rainwater, is the groundwater, the same that homes drill down to for their wells. We'll come back to that in a moment. We make our way upstream just as the morning high tide recedes. Newly fallen trees and large chunks of the bluff litter the beach, evidence of what appears to many to be an accelerated rate of erosion this spring. What Radenbaugh likes to do is use the face of the cliff to point out the geological layers, a good place to start.
You see the big rocks and the small rocks. It's pretty much an unsorted jumble of rock, very porous. You know, a lot of process, it basically means the water can flow through it fairly easily, and that's glacial till, and it's basically around 300,000 years ago, a couple glacial periods back. Then right above it, there's an abrupt change, and above that you see finer sediments. There's a little bit of sorting right above. You see the small cobbles,
yeah,
and pebbles. That there's an unconformity there. Basically, there's a time gap. Things got eroded, and then dumped on top of that is that kind of clay stuff, which is kind of a later glacial period, still more estuarine. And then above that, we see the real fine, no rock in it. That's lust. That's wind-blown stuff. And that's the most recent, you know, 10,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago or so. Then above that, you start seeing some bands and some soil layers. There's, I can actually see some little tiny pebble bits. That's probably pumice from Annie Encheck 3,500 years ago. And when it blew up, there was actually ash and a tsunami deposits. That's at the very top. And above that, we start seeing some peat. And all this is unconsolidated sediment. In other words, it's not glued together. So it moves.
Shorelines all over the U.S., not just in Alaska, erode for different reasons. Some past studies suggested Kanakanak's erosion might be due to ice scouring in the winter as the tides move ice chunks or the frozen shoreline up and down, etc. Look closely at the cliff and you'll see areas where water is dripping, seeping, sometimes pouring out. And Radenbaugh suggests this is the primary cause of the erosion.
So you can see it flowing down here. So this water
is groundwater. We have a high water table in this area, and the more rain we have, the higher the water table is. And we've had a fairly wet spring into early summer. And that water comes out. In the wintertime, it freezes, and then it plucks sediment out. Right now, that groundwater, as you can see, has saturated this cliff face. And it makes it more prone to landslides or mass wasting events, as we would say.
What's it called?
Mass wasting. Mass wasting is a large movement of rock and sediment, a regolith. And there's quite a bit of mass wasting going on here.
We don't go very far until we find a spot where water is literally gushing out of the cliff. But why is it eroding so much lately? Anyone living near Kinakinak's Bluffs, this reporter included, can tell you it's going quick. Call it climate change or El Nino, Radenbaugh says the warm, snowless winters are likely a main factor.
As long as you have groundwater, it's not going to be frozen, and it's going to move out. But if we had the water tied up in a snowpack, then yeah, there would be the water table would be lowered, and there'd be less water coming out of the cliff. There'd be less erosion, right? So the more water you have, the more active these slopes are going to be. We've had a really active winter and into the spring because we had very little snowpack. We had lots of precipitation, and that goes right into the groundwater system, which then we're seeing the influence. So yeah, I think it's much more active in the last couple of years because we haven't had a cold winters.
He points out that a spring melting from a good snow year would produce more surface runoff, less water seeping into the soils where it permeates to the water table, eventually towards the cliff, loosening layers as it goes. We walk down a half mile or so to inspect a particularly large section that had just given way a few days before. Radenbaugh and retired Fish and Wildlife Service employee Paul Lieberg ran a tape to measure the pile of earth.
Another foot and a half. Of course, it slopes down here.
Some hasty calculations produced a radio-friendly figure.
That's your number. It'd be like 85 dump truck loads, maybe, that have just sloughed off here.
They later walked that number back a bit, but still, one gets a sense of how much earth is moving from the shore out to the bay. Within a week, most of that material had been swept into the Nooshigak, adding to the bay's turbidity. Lieberg is also a city councilman and keeps thinking about the next big question: what are we going to do about this?
Understanding what's going on here and seeing examples like the sloughing that we just looked at are good, but the real question, I think, for the community, for any community, is how we go forward and how we make decisions based on this information that we have now or that we're learning.
At these rates of erosion, the Nooshigak will close in on several homes, dirt roads, and maybe even Kinakinak Road within the next couple of years. The Health Corp just built their new dental clinic confusingly near to the cliff. Seawalls are expensive and probably won't work. Other options are few, except to move inland. Standing amidst a pile of freshly eroded debris, I asked Radenbaugh if, as a scientist, he can acknowledge it's a little depressing.
Depressing? Well, from a societal perspective, if you own the property, it can be depressing. But from a just a dynamic perspective, to see nature happening, all this groundwater coming out, we see all this movement. It's what nature does. It's with destruction, there's rebirth. You know, it's kind of like the Vishnu thing, right? It's that death allows other things to live. This cliff is made to move through these processes. It's our society that needs to realize how the processes work and mitigate our behavior. We don't do that very well. We like to fortify it and build it, and because we have this idea that we own this property, when it's obvious at this rate of movement, these processes are going to do what these processes do because they've been doing this for millennium. Talk about time immemorial, that's it.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment.
You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. I know a man, he came from my hometown.
fishing for his woman like a thorny crown.
Well, along with fishermen tuning up their boats this month, there are lots of other workers gearing up for the season. Welders, net hangers, cannery workers, all streaming in to support the salmon industry. This year, there's a new piece of that fishery puzzle in the bay, a local brailer business in Naknek. KDLG's Hannah Colton caught up with them and has this story.
I'm like millions of grommet. These are all grommet.
I'm standing with Diane Hill in her kitchen.
It's where all the magic happens.
On a wide table across from an industrial sewing machine, there's a grommet machine. It punches those little metal rings into the black polyester mesh fabric that Hill's working with.
Well, I'm setting up the grommets, and now I've got the strapping in place, and here we go. It's so fun. I love this.
Hill is the manager and chief and only seamstress of Bristol Bay Brailer LLC. The company is owned by her husband, Bill, his two brothers, Nathan and Carl, and their business partner, Russell Phelps. They're all fishermen, and she says they'd been talking for years about the need for locally produced brailers.
Why don't we make brailers here? We've been buying them from other places, but we're in the heart of fishing, so why don't we make them here? And there was some money available in a grant form from the Foraker Group.
They were selected in the fall in the business competition funded by Anglo American, and Hill started sewing brailers over the winter. Now, if you haven't been on a fishing boat lately, a brailer bag is the bag that sits in the hold and gets filled with fish.
And then when you get to the tender, they hook it up and haul it out of your boat to the tender, and then they dump the fish in the tender.
And just like boats and nets and cooling systems have changed with new technologies, brailers have evolved a lot over the years.
We dug one up over right here.
We step out into Hill's yard, where a recent weed whacking mission has uncovered an old brailer bag from the 70s. It's made of knotted orange rope, and you can imagine how the 2-inch netting would put big cross hatches in the fish.
And this really damages the fish. And this bag here will probably hold good 1,500 pounds, which, you know, they just don't do that anymore.
Most brailers are smaller now. They hold up to 800 or maybe 1,000 pounds. And most are made of a smooth mesh fabric to keep the salmon in better shape. Hill says the company Nomar in Homer was one of the first to make these fabric bags. And just a few years ago, when prices were better, she says Bristol Bay fishermen would just order in new bags from Homer or wherever. But money is tighter now for many fishermen. And with the bay-wide push toward chilling fish and refrigerated seawater systems, Hill says there's more of a need for custom-made brailers.
You know, people putting in RSW or just, you know, like doing a flush deck, and that will change the size of your bins. And I've got a client right now who did that. So he just needed a few bags to fit in bins that were, you know, now a different size.
Besides being able to deliver faster than bigger companies, Hill says being small-time allows her some freedom to be creative. She's constantly tweaking her product to make it better. For example, she points out a spot on the bottom of a brailer. She says there would normally be a grommet there, a grommet that hooks up to a tag line, which is how the brailer gets pulled up to dump fish.
And it seemed like such an over-designed part of the bag because it doesn't really hold any weight. It just kind of compromises the bag when you've got another hole in it.
So she got rid of that grommet. She put a heavy-duty strap in its place.
And I had somebody, you know, when I delivered a bag to them yesterday, they said, well, they normally have a grommet. I said, yeah, I know, but we're going to try something new. I think this will hold it on there. And that's the thing, is taking this product, and that's how it's gone over time. So, you know, the other company came in and from the big mesh bags and made it a better bag. And now we just have to keep making it better, make the product better. The whole industry is getting better. Why can't the bag get better?
After this summer, the Hills are hoping to move their operation out of their kitchen. They'll move into a new building and eventually hope to hire about 5 people locally. And they imagine expanding soon beyond brailers to make slush bags, backpacks for collapsible kayaks. Diane jokes, maybe she'll make totes to sell to cannery workers when they're lugging 24 packs back from the liquor store. It's whatever she can dream up, really. Reporting in Naknek, I'm Hannah Colton.
Last year around this time on this program, we featured a young Dillingham poet who won the Alaska Dispatch and University of Alaska Creative Writing Contest in the poetry category. That was Sherry O'Connor of Dillingham. We're pleased to tell you that another young person from our listening area has won that same category this year. Her name is Alexandria Ivanoff, and she was born and raised in Unalakleet. We hope they're listening today on KNSA. Ivanoff is 14 years old and is on her summer break between the freshman and sophomore years. I spoke with her dad, Paul, a little bit earlier today.
Well, you know, we have two kids, and we try to expose our kids to a lot of different things in and out of the village, and creative art, creative music, sports, of course. It's such a joy, and sometimes it's really a challenge to get children to think outside the village, and that's one of our goals with our kids.
He shared a little bit about her winning entry, which we'll share with you just after this.
This is a poem that's about one of her favorite places, and that's our fish camp that's 22 miles up the Unalakleet River. And the poem pretty much sums up one of her favorite things to do, and that's going camping in the fall and late fall.
About 500 entries were submitted from young writers around Alaska. First place in the middle school poetry division went to Alexandria Ivanoff from Unalakleet with the poem, Where Am I From?
Where Am I From? By Alexandria Ivanoff. I am from scrumptious sourdough pancakes cooking in the morning haze, from Folger's coffee brewing and the birds chirping in the break of dawn. I am from the small red cabin miles up the river, the security of knowing I could just be. I am from the sweet-smelling bluebells, the evergreen pines, whose long-gone limbs I remember as if they were my own. I am from tree-climbing and net-checking, from Aiden to Anne, from Papa Paul to Alan, and Beth to B-Bucks. I am from joking and stubborn and creativity and will. I am from Let's Go and I Love You. I'm from Giving Away Your First Catch. I am from Alaska and Inupiaq family. From dry fish and strips, from getting caught in the net like my little brother, and their cautiousness ever since. The old wood stove and guns never to fire again. The memories here will never be forgotten.
Again, that was Alexandria Ivanoff, a 14-year-old from Unalakleet. Well, before we wrap up this week's show, we have one more story to get to, and I'm happy to have Teresa Duncan in the studio to share it with us. The fishing fleet will be blessed this Sunday in Dillingham, and there's a song sung every year. Teresa Duncan has a little bit more about this. Thanks for being back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Tell us about this song that we do hear every year before we get a sample from you.
Okay. This song is called We Ask Your Blessings, and Priscilla Scrady wrote that. She's got it as Celia Scrady on her song title. She came to my house more than 20 years ago. She was moving from the area, and she stopped over to my house, and she said, Teresa, you've got to take this blessing of the fleet and go forward with it, because if you don't, nobody will. Nobody else is going to be here after I leave. Somebody's got to carry this forward. And she said, you've got to just continue doing the blessing of the fleet every year. And I missed a few years, but Priscilla was her heart and soul was in this community. She lived here for a lot of years. And as she was leaving, she wanted to make sure that this blessing continued on and on. And so here's her song, We Ask Your Blessings.
Take it away.
We are gathering together by the shores of Bristol Bay. We come to ask your blessings on our fishers and our fleet as we stand in quiet harmony and bow our heads to pray. We bring our open hearts and lay them humbly at your feet. We ask your blessings on the fishers going to sea. We ask your blessings on each one's family. We ask your blessings in the wind and in the rain. We ask you, Father, bring them safely home again. Our traditions were your destiny, some choices have been made. Our faiths have many labels, and some differences is true. Standing here together in the sunshine or in shade, scanning o'er the faces, we are still the same to you. We ask your blessings on the fishers going to sea. We ask your blessings on each one's family. We ask your blessings in the wind and in the rain. We ask you, Father, bring them safely home again. We remember all the people whose lives were lost at sea. We praise you for the oceans you have filled for us to share. We thank you for the blessings you have given lovingly. We ask you to watch over us and hold us in your care. We ask your blessings on the fishers going to sea. We ask your blessings on each one's family. We ask your blessings in the wind and in the rain. We ask you, Father, bring them safely home again.
Well, that's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. My thanks to our guests, as well as Hannah Colton, Molly Dishner, and our newest addition to the KDLG News team, Shaylin Cochran, who comes to us from 4 years reporting on the Kenai Peninsula. As a programming note, we'll be aggressively following all the fishery and summer news right here on KDLG and our comprehensive nightly fisheries report. We'll be back starting Monday, June 13th. You can contact any of us anytime with feedback and ideas. Send them to news@kdlg.org or give us a call at the station. I'm your host, Dave Benier. Glad to be on board for another summer with you here. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. See you next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you.